Thanks, Jill. Good evening, everybody. It's great to be with you. My name's Rob Imberger. As Ashley said, I'm a bit sick, but I'm also the pastor here at 6:30. This sermon brought to you by Codrell tonight. As Ashley said, we've been going through the environment series. I just want to recap about 3 weeks in about 2 minutes and then give you a bit of a platform for where we head tonight. This is where we land. Our fourth week looking at basically how God made the world, why he made it, thinking of how sin fits into all of that and how Jesus fits into all of that as well. And first week we looked at the creation account, how God made the world, and we talked about how science and Christianity don't have to be in opposition at all. In fact, they work together. And we talked about God as creator and the rest of everything else as being creature. We talked about idolatry or worshipping created stuff instead of the creator in the midst of all that. Then in week two, we talked about how God made people. He made them as men and women, and he made them in his image for relationship with him. And when he said, go and rule the world, he said, rule it in relationship with me in the way that I would do it. And then last time from Steve, we heard about the fact that creation praises God, and that's great, but it also groans, waiting for its renewal, its recreation. So there's something wrong. We know that. We look around, we see climate change, we see some sort of abuse going on of earth, of people, and we know that there's a recreation, a renewal being waiting. We also know that Jesus has something to do with it, and tonight that's where we kind of land tonight. It's been leading us here in our final night, and I wonder if it prompts a question in you. Talking about the environment, we're talking about created stuff, we're talking about the earth and material stuff. Is that right to talk about Jesus in the same sentence? Because isn't he all about the soul and spiritual things and kind of very heavenly-minded stuff, stuff that's kind of pure and lovely and up there, as opposed to matter and earth, which is sort of down here and not very nice, evil kind of, dirty, not less than God. Why is Jesus in the midst of that? Well, it was certainly the worldview that Paul was battling against when he wrote the letter to the Colossians. This idea of dualism was rampant. The idea that there was kind of two realities, spiritual, good, pleasant, heavenly, perfect, and then there was physical, you know, evil, bad, matter, earth, dirty stuff. And if you wanted to be a kind of a proper person or someone who kind of embodied the nobler things of life, you would pursue the things of the spiritual. You'd become a philosopher. You'd think about and talk about ideas. You would never get your hands dirty like a carpenter. There are modern day versions of this. It's like a sacred secular divide. You know, for example, ministers like me, we do full-time work for God, but the rest of the Christians only do part-time work for God, so there are spiritual jobs and there are unspiritual jobs. Another sacred secular classic is, well, the earth is kind of my waiting room. I'm here waiting to get to heaven, but this is all it is. I'm kind of passing through. Eventually, we'll get to my real home. That's a sacred secular divide. Another sacred secular divide is that what we do in the church on a Sunday is much more Christian than what we do Monday to Saturday out there. That's unchristian. So we need to do more stuff in here rather than in there. That's all dualism repackaged. The idea that there's a spiritual reality that's all perfect and lovely, but the earthly material stuff is not. I don't believe that's biblical. And tonight we'll see, because of Jesus, he just breaks apart that mold and just shows us how shockingly creation-centered he is. We're going to get that from Colossians 1. So that was the reading you heard first. If you could flip back there, that would be awesome. I'm going to basically just go through it bit by bit because it's just so awesome. It's meaty and it's chunky. And I think that you'll see the kind of depth of truth that we're dealing with here. I could take 40 sermons. So verse 15 is where I'm going to start. Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. I'm actually just going to stop right there. Jesus is the image of the invisible God. Amazing thought. Picked up in our second week. That God would make people in his own image. And so when he wants to make himself known to the world, he comes as a human. This already proves what dignity and worth human beings have. That Jesus would come to be one. He didn't come as a rock. He didn't come as a river. He didn't come as a painting. He didn't come as a waterfall. He comes as a human being. And Jesus perfectly mirrors God. If we want to know what God's like, we go, Jesus, look at him. So humanity, in that respect, has to get its bearings and its meaning and its truth from Jesus. I find that fascinating, that little phrase people use when they say they've done something wrong. They say to me, I'm only human, Rob. Give me some credit. Everyone stuffs up. I'm only human. And it's a funny phrase because it's not actually human in its true sense. It's not using that term human at all in its biblical sense. That person was really using human in the biblical sense. They were saying, I was less than human there, Rob. I was less than human when I stuffed up. Because true humanity, as Jesus defines it, is perfection. Christians are actually growing up to be perfectly human, not less than human. Jesus is the image of the invisible God. It's a similar idea in verse 19, if you want to look down, that God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in Jesus. Again, an amazing truth. We don't need any fuller revelation of who God is than who Jesus has shown himself to be. We don't need a fuller kind of revelation from somewhere else. We don't need someone else saying, this is really who God is now. Just Jesus. So Jesus, this is God's truth. He's saying he is pleased. Not just he was okay to have Jesus embody his fullness, but he was pleased to let all his fullness, everything that God is seen in Jesus. Who he is, what he's like, how he acts, what his character is, what his perfection is, and so on. I could keep going for 20 minutes right there. We're going to kick on to verse 16. For by Jesus, all things were created, things in heaven and on earth. Now, this shouldn't surprise us at first. All that we've been learning so far is that God's a creator. God gets dirt under his fingernails, so to speak, when he creates people. He kind of gets the dust from the earth and breathes life into Adam. But Jesus, the creator. That's odd, isn't it? Or Jesus, the worker. The fact that, can you imagine Jesus working? The Son of God. This one by whom all things were created. It's not what the Greeks or the Romans would have expected from their gods, let me say. Work or creating stuff was really disdained by Greek and Roman mythology. Dualism, remember, there was work, there was, you know, you'd never be a worker down here getting your hands dirty. You'd always be a noble person, philosopher, etc. And if Greek or Roman gods came in human form, they would certainly never expected a carpenter who got splinters under his fingernails. Do you hear the scope of this? For by Jesus, all things were created. Things in heaven and on earth. You might be wondering why then Paul singles out thrones and powers and rulers and authorities. I think there are a couple of reasons. Mainly to do with whether Jesus really is supreme. Whether he really is supreme over the things that seem to be supreme. What I mean is this. History tells us in Colossae, the church that Paul's writing to, they were getting freaked out a bit, this church. Some visitors were coming to preach and they were saying, hey, we can give you supernatural access to God. Or we can give you, we don't know exactly what their line of argument was, but it was something along the lines of, we can give you a powerful heavenly forces encounter. It was other than distinct from God. It's quite possible this new church was kind of being led astray by that. That they were looking for something extra, other than God, something super spiritual. And so what was at stake really was the supremacy of Christ. That is, could we as Christians be sure that Christ is the highest power, the highest authority, the highest glory, the highest wonder and specter. And thus was he worthy of my allegiance, more powerful than any other power. It's a good question then, it's a good question now. And the reply from Paul to us, to the church of Colossae, is this, loud and clear, paraphrasing verse 16. Whatever power those people claim, Christ made it, he's above it, he can take it away, he can give it. In short, Christ is supreme. And then the second half, the 16 and then 17. All things were created by and for Jesus. He is before all things. And in him all things hold together. All things were created for Jesus. That's the only way I can explain the calming of the storm story. We just heard that read. The disciples use a curious little word at the end of their, whoa, what's going on here? They say, who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? Just, it's almost like they're talking as if the wind and waves belong to Jesus. That they know that he's their master. The wind and waves do exist for Jesus. And then this says, they existed after Jesus, he existed before them, and in him the wind and waves hold together. It's very hard for our heads to get around, isn't it? But it's so profound and so cool. There's only someone who is before anything can hold anything together. Only someone who benefits from everything is worth everything being for. I just hope that expands your idea of Jesus Christ. Just hold that for a moment. This is a reality check, I suppose, for us to take on how balanced our view of God's Son really is. Because we could take one of two extremes in looking at Jesus. We could only look at who he reveals himself to be as an earthly person. And you get in the Gospels, Jesus the peacemaker, Jesus the quiet revolutionary, Jesus the one who touched the untouchable, Jesus the, you know, misunderstood martyr, Mary's son, a humble carpenter. You could get just that picture of him. And do you, just think about this, do you major on him? Or this other picture of Jesus, that this preeminent son of God, Colossians 1's description of him, Philippians 2, every knee shall bow, every tongue confess. Revelation, a picture of Jesus being the almighty judge and king and warrior. And then you've got, you know, John 1, we just heard that by Ashley. He was in the beginning and was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's kind of a really cosmic description of who Jesus is. But if you only have one of them, there's danger. There's danger to holding on to only one kind of Jesus. You hold on to the Gospels account and nothing else, you get no cosmic Christ. You get no forge. Everything's for him, through him, to him. But if you only look at the cosmic Christ, then you get the sacred secular divide. Of course you do. Suddenly earth is somehow not as good as heaven. Abraham Kuyper, a Puritan theologian, said it like this. There is not one square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who's sovereign over all, does not cry, mine. Crack on to verse 18. Jesus is the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead. So, we haven't even gotten to the church yet in this whole section, and you might expect that if we're talking about Jesus, we'd just be talking about the church, but no. It's really cool that we're not, because as we've learned already, Jesus' rule is so vast, he's so supreme, that he's got a stake on everything, every square inch. When we get that in our heads, we're ready to hear what relationship he has with the church. And this says, he's the head of the church. Firstborn among the dead. Not he's been created, he's the firstborn, the first created one, but He's been resurrected. The first one to be resurrected and stay alive. The firstborn from the dead. That after death he lived and he would start a whole generation of resurrected people, the Christians, among whom he has the supremacy. And in fact, the resurrection, I could spend 80 minutes on this, is the like first sign of recreation, renewal. It's a taste. Jesus' resurrection is a taste of what's to come in the end. So you get in Jesus' death, destruction, injustice, violence. But then in his resurrection, you get restoration, vindication, peace. That's a pattern that's going to get repeated as things are renewed and recreated and ultimately when Jesus comes back. From destruction to restoration, from injustice to vindication, from violence to peace. And we hear, we all know, creation, people, non-human creation also groaning out for that transformation. And I'll just keep going through to verse 20. Also my voice holds out. God, through Jesus, is pleased to reconcile to himself all things on earth or in heaven by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. I just want to get the vastness of that statement because Jesus' cross achieves reconciliation between people and God. And that's big enough, right? It's amazing to think that God would take the initiative to send his son to come to us when we were running far from him, to pay the price that we would come together again, to be reconciled, that peace would be made through his cross. That's a big thing. That's a lot. And yet even more than that, Jesus' cross makes possible reconciliation, not just of hostile people, but a hostile creation. The whole of non-human creation to God. I think it's good and right that we emphasize people needing reconciliation to God. Our sin does need a remedy, absolutely. But we also have to speak of the reconciliation of non-human recreation to God as well. Colossians 1:20, I'll say it in a different way, is teaching Jesus' cross has the power to destroy all evil in all its forms. Natural disaster, disease, poverty, and so on. All evil can be destroyed by the cross of Jesus. And as I said earlier, Jesus' resurrection is the first sign of that recreation, that restoration. I think that gives the church really exciting purpose today. The people of God have exciting vision because of that today. Because you think about it, if Jesus is supreme, another word we use to call him, that is Lord. If he is supreme Lord, and if his cross has the power to destroy all evil, if the resurrection is the proof of that, he has the power to destroy and recreate, then just think how exciting our task becomes. Our task becomes exciting because we get to proclaim Jesus is supreme. Therefore, all people are summoned to beg, bow down and give allegiance to him. We can look at every sphere of life, whether we're a church, whether we're in our personal homes, whether we're in our public life, as one where Jesus already has the supremacy. And so we'll work to ensure that those areas reflect his supremacy. So we repair them where they're broken, we'll nurture them where they're healthy, and we'll challenge them when they're corrupt. Let me give you an example. So a guy who's now CEO of a very well-known company in Australia. He's a Christian, and one of his earlier jobs was as a CEO of a certain company, and it had a factory. And he got a tour on his first day at this factory. As a CEO, he can ask for what he wants. And the foreman was taking him around, and he got to the part of the factory floor where some of these guys who worked in the factory put up pornographic pictures on the wall. And this guy, the boss, walks around and he gets to that spot and he says to the foreman, just stop there for a moment. He walks over he tears all the posters down off the wall. He asks the foreman to recommence the tour and he keeps going. No fuss, no, you know, I can't believe you're doing this, just took them down. And afterwards he had the women come up to him saying, you know, thank you, we can't tell you how much we appreciate that. See, what George was doing was seeing Jesus as Lord over this factory. So let's act like it. Jesus is Lord over this corner of the factory. Let's act like it. So he tore down those posters as a way, I think, of reflecting the supremacy of Jesus in that factory. I'm sure you can think of examples in your own lives where Jesus is Lord and he's supreme. You can act like it. You can change or influence structures to make it look like it. You can nurture where it's beginning to look like it. Excuse me. So today the federal government introduced the carbon pricing about, you know, however many hours ago, and that will all affect us in some way, shape or form in the future. That was the catalyst for Brian bringing us this series. And we trust that God's used it in some way to provoke you, to stir you. You can pick up one of these resources lists. Again, they'll be available afterwards if you'd like to do some more digging. But basically, let me say, broadly speaking, over these last 4 weeks, what we've tried to do is actually a snapshot of what I've just tried to do in this talk. To say that there's no topic, whether it's, you know, political or otherwise, beyond Christ's domain. There's no subject that can't be preached upon. There's no thing that God doesn't have an opinion on, since Jesus is supreme. He's got such a wondrous rule. And I want to thank him for that and pray. So let's do that now. God, Almighty God, it is amazing. We read these words, particularly in Colossians, and are just astounded at the cosmic rule of Christ. It's hard for us to get our heads around that he is before all things, by him all things are created, in him all things hold together. Would you do your work in us, Lord, just to open our minds and our eyes to that a bit more because of tonight? And would you help us look around us, look within us? Help us surrender those parts of our lives that are not under your supremacy, where we are bowing down to other idols or believing other truths. And would you help us look around us to see that you are Lord, you are already Lord over our schools and unis, our workplaces and our homes. Help us act like it. This is hard to do, Lord, because some of these truths are hard to get our heads around. So as we look around your created world and as we look to see how we best use it but not abuse it, how we best enjoy it as good but not as God, please change us. Change our habits and practices. Change our minds and hearts. We pray all this through your Spirit's power and by your Son's name. Amen.